Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Changes. My guest today is Louise Kennedy. Louise grew up in Belfast, now lives in Sligo in the south of Ireland. She worked as a chef for almost 30 years before signing up for a writing group in 2014, after which the course of her life changed completely. Her debut novel, Trespasses, is a love story between a Protestant and a Catholic set in a small town near Belfast in 1975 at the height of the Troubles. It came out last year and has been a huge success. It was awarded Novel of the Year for a myriad of publications from the Times to The Guardian. Then it won Debut of the Year at the British Book Awards, Irish Novel of the Year at the An Post Book Awards, as well as being shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Louise Kennedy, hello. Welcome to Changes. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Hello, Andy. Thank you very much for having me.
Congratulations on Trespasses.
Thank you very much.
You are now living the life of an international writer. Does it feel real yet? The fact that the book has travelled so far and moved so many people.
I don't know, it sort of does and it doesn't. Maybe, at festivals and stuff like that. Or if I go on the internet, I think, well, geez, there was a book. But the rest of the time, it doesn't really feel, I don't know, in some ways it feels like somebody else wrote it.
Would you call yourself an author? I mean, obviously I would call you an author, but I don't know what relationship you have with that word.
No, I don't know. I even seem like a wanker when I call myself a writer. So I think I'm much happier with the doing than the being or something.
Yeah.
It's weird. I mean, I never felt like that. I mean, I didn't say I cook, you know, when I used to be a chef and people said, what do you do? You know, I didn't mind saying I was a chef. I think when I was a child, I thought that writers are like magical people or something. And maybe I don't want to presume to say that I'm a writer.
There's so many things I want to talk about. You just touched on the fact that you were a chef for 30 years. I think a lot of the people who listen to this podcast will be really inspired by how you came to writing and will want to hear that story. But let's start at the start, if that's okay, and touch on the biggest change that you went through in your childhood. So what was that?
The biggest change probably happened in 1975 when, after a couple of bomb attacks on the pub that my granny owned, that my mother worked in it and my uncle worked in it. It was very much a part of my childhood. I was kind of rare to bump, really.
Can I ask what the family was? So you had mum and dad. Did you have brothers and sisters and stuff as well?
Yeah, so I'm the eldest. At the time, I was the eldest of three girls. And then after we left the north and moved to the south, my mother had the boy she had long been waiting for.
Right.
But in May 73, a bomb was planted in the pub and it was discovered and defused. And then in 74, another attempt was made, and this time the bomb detonated. Now, reasonable warning had been given, so the place had been cleared, but the building was damaged. But I think even more than that, there was a message in there that maybe people didn't want us in the town anymore or were putting us out of business.
And can you give us the context of that, Louise, just for those who might not understand? I'm not expecting you to explain the entire history of sectarian Northern Ireland, but in terms of your place and the pub's place, why would they have not wanted you there?
So Trespasses is a work of fiction. My novel is a work of fiction, but it's very much based on, I suppose, on my background. So we were part of a small Catholic community in a predominantly Protestant town. We were made up about 10%. On the surface, things often looked to be quite polite, but there was an undercurrent of sectarianism that was systemic, but also there was sort of day-to-day stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that the Catholic middle class really seemed to me to be made up of bookies, publicans, a few doctors and a few solicitors.
And tell us why you think that is.
The reason I think that is because I think that providing drinking and gambling services, those were businesses that maybe Protestants didn't want to be associated with because they were considered immoral. Catholics, it didn't seem to have any such qualms. Or maybe it's because it was all that was available to them.
I should just put in here and say, and for those who don't know, the history of the sectarian conflict in Northern Ireland is that Catholics did not have rights to jobs in the same way, or housing in the same way that Protestants did.
There was
slim pickings.
Very slim pickings, exactly. Yeah, so I think as well, there did seem to be a pattern. People have maybe been able to figure this out later on, that maybe Catholics who were doing well, their businesses tended to be targeted. But it also might be as simple as if you have a pub, your name's over the door and people know where to find you. So, you know, I suppose at the time, by the time that our pub was attacked, there'd already been a few years of a campaign of sectarian killing.
And what kind of woman was your grandmother?
She's kind of great, actually. She herself had been badly injured in a bomb in 1971.
Wow.
Yeah, really badly injured, actually. Still badly, so that it was initially reported as a fatality.
What?
Yeah, but I mean, she would never have used, she'd never, ever have used the word trauma. She wouldn't have known what it meant. And the only time she ever kind of alluded to the bomb was to tell this story to entertain people, which was that she'd had several surgeries and she'd hundreds of stitches and, you know, she'd lost a lot of blood and she'd been sedated. And when she came around, there was someone around standing over her she'd never seen in her life. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm one of the ambulance drivers." And apparently, she had been on her way to the bank with the takings from the pub,
right,
to make a lodgement. When this bomb exploded, this random bomb exploded in the town. And,
okay, so she wasn't a target. She was just walking past.
Oh, she was still, she was just walking past the pub. But he said that they nearly had to break her arm to get the handbag off her with the money in it. That there was no way.
Oh my God.
He was parsing with it.
So even like unconscious or whatever.
Unconscious
she's like...
and bleeding to death, she wasn't parting with the money. So, wow. I mean, I get them. You know, she's pretty a brilliant kind of a person. Now, she did all of her life have really overt signs of what we would now call post-traumatic stress. You know, if there was a loud noise, she went to pieces. And, you know, she probably had struggles with alcohol later on as well, which we probably didn't particularly know, just because everybody seemed to have struggles with alcohol.
Yeah,
but she was kind of great, you know. But anyway, after the second attempt at bombing our pub, there was a conversation about whether things should keep going and wait around for a third bomb, in which you know people might be killed, or else just to pack up and leave. So that's what they did, and it meant that when the pub was sold in 1975, I went from living within walking distance of all the relatives on my father's side to most of them being gone, and I think that was a really significant change. For me.
Because you had this big extended family community of people that were available and accessible to you.
Yeah, my father's family, they all got on very well. My father was the eldest of six kids and they were so much fun when they were all together. And there was, I think I just really missed them terribly when they were gone. And in some ways, maybe they hadn't moved very far away, but it just felt like a world away. They moved, I guess, 100-odd miles down the road and bought a pub in Kildare, and then they were gone.
Right. And they say it takes a village to raise a child. Like, you must have been so influenced by so many of them.
I think so. It was like, my aunts, you know, my uncles and their wives, you know, when they had babies and stuff, they'd met me, wheeled a nappy pin over their newborns and things. And great crack. Yeah.
So they moved and then yous moved.
Yeah. So I think around 4 years later, we left. And I guess that was kind of for reasons to do with the troubles as well, maybe different reasons. My father found himself in a job, which, should have been a promotion, I guess, except that he was the only Catholic in a workforce of about 150 people, and that was very difficult for him at work. Yeah. And a couple of times he was followed home, you know, from the factory to the end of our driveway. By 1979, it had become pretty intolerable, I think, for them. So we left as well.
I just can't imagine like living with that level of fear.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. I don't want to put fear on. I don't want to say that's the word, but that level of tension.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, I don't know. I think I was always aware of this kind of, not particularly low level anxiety, actually, but because it was all the time, you're kind of used to it. And I suppose children, especially, are people are very, very adaptable, you know? So, we had bomb scares in school and stuff like that. On the one hand, you'd be a bit terrified, but on the other hand, it was a way to get out of a classroom. And, I can remember playing, pretending to be Charlie's Angels. We used to be evacuated into the church. So very dramatic. I remember playing Charlie's Angels with some of the girls in my class and getting slapped around the head for it, in the church, that kind of thing. So, So in some ways, it became very normal. I think maybe towards the end, after the bomb and then after that, it just became really, really pretty frightening and difficult.
And for those, again, who don't understand how things worked, you alluded to the fact that the pub got bombed, which is were warned, so you were able to evacuate. What was the process of how those things were done? Was it a phone call? How was one warned?
I think with the first one, there hadn't been a warning, actually. But the first one, a customer had passed a van. I think they could see that there was a beer keg in the vehicle, which looked unfamiliar. Anyway, I suppose it was a place that kind of regulars drank in.
Yeah.
And there were wires sticking out of it. So they went in and said, well, that looks like a bomb. So that was, I think there was like 150 pounds of explosives in it or something. And that was defused. And then the second time, I'm not sure, actually, I must ask. I'm not sure exactly about the warning. Very often it was a phone call, sometimes to the premises, where it might have been to the police or something.
Obviously, you spent a year talking solidly about this book. And I know from experience that the first question people ask is, where did this book come from?
Yeah.
So have you learnt about your own motivations for writing the book since talking about it? I mean, there has got to be a reason why you set the book at this time that was so rupturing for you and your life, I suppose.
Yeah.
And also in that place that meant so much to you.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've been flitting around the place saying, oh, I'm writing a novel, but I wasn't actually really doing a lot. I made a couple of playlists and was having many a hilarious hour watching.
I love that you started it with playlists.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I spent many a kind of delightful hour watching videos of like the REC in the 70s and things like that.
Yeah.
And I made some notes, but really I haven't got anywhere with it. And then in March 2019, I got a diagnosis for melanoma and I had some surgery. And I knew I was going to be off work for up to 3 months. And I suppose I have cancer again, like for the second time. And I think that's really, people are saying, oh, you're great, but I'm not great at all. I just deal with it by completely avoiding it. And because I'm not on chemo, I'm on a different type of treatment. It means that it's possible for me to, you can't really avoid it if your hair's falling out and you're throwing up and stuff, you know. Anyway, I had some surgery and I spent a couple of days, I think 3 days watching Call My Agent all through series. It was many days and taking some kind of opioids that they gave me in the hospital. And then I just thought, you have to get in the chair and do something. I had an agent, but I didn't have a publisher or anything. And I didn't think anybody would ever see it. So really just to kind of stop myself from cracking up and worrying about whether I might be dying or not, I set myself a task that I try and write 1,000 words every day. I also made myself promise, you know, that I wouldn't look back at the absolute drivel I'd written the previous day, because if I had, that would have completely put me off, just to keep pushing forward.
Yeah.
And also that I'd forgive myself if I flaked beyond time, you know, on account of me being like sick and very worried about myself. So I didn't really feel like I was getting a lot done, but after 11 weeks, I appeared to have about 65,000 words of a draft.
Right.
That was desperate. Yeah. It was very poor. And it took a hell of a lot of work to clear it up. I think maybe part of the reason I chose to write this particular story and set it in that time, I thought that I was plucking 1975 out of the air, but that is the year that, you know, that was a year of massive change in my childhood. And maybe, you know, it's a work of fiction, but it is kind of the story of my family or people like us, you know. Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe because I thought I might be dying, that was the story that I wanted to tell or something. It sounds really dramatic that I might be dying. Like, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know if I was or not. You know, I had to wait for a while to see.
So how long did you have to wait?
Well, I had to wait until the rooms confirmed for me with scans that they figured that they got all the melanoma. And that seemed to be going okay until it became very clear then that they had got all the melanoma about a year and a half later. Mm. Yeah, so when it came back. Yeah, I appeared to be at stage 4 and then ended up, you know, on the completely other course of drugs.
And you said you have it again now, or are you in remission?
I'm still in treatment. Ultimately, you know, the outlook was pretty poor. But there are these drugs that if they work, they really work. So after 8 months on these mad medicines, I was tumor free. So the optimal time to take this course of drugs is 2 years. I think I'm finished at the end of November.
Okay, so not long now. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that was a catalyst for deciding to write a novel. But how else has it changed you, I suppose, this diagnosis, your outlook, your perspective, the way you live your life, anything like that?
I think that I probably would have considered myself to be a very anxious person before I started writing, or maybe the reason that I started writing, I started writing by accident, but maybe the reason that I took to it or something was that myself and my husband, I'd been a chef and we had a restaurant for around 7 years. And really, Within about 6 months of it opening, it was kind of doomed, I suppose. We opened it in 2007, and then by 2008, we were looking at each other going, where the hell is everybody? Just because the economy was so bad. And somehow we managed to limp along for 7 years. And really, I was the complete and utter mess by the time that restaurant closed. Yeah, I'd stop sleeping and put on weight. I was on antidepressants again. Oh, this was like a recurring thing from when I was younger. I think maybe when I was about 7 or 8, I started to have like sleeping problems. Oh, like very neurotic sort of behavior as well. But there were things that other kids in my class seemed to be able to do very easily that I just couldn't do it. And a lot of anxiety. But yeah, I mean, I get myself in a bit of a state before a scan, like a terrible state.
Jesus, fucking understandable.
But actually, I don't really worry about anything anymore.
You don't worry about anything
anymore?
I just
don't worry about anything.
Wow.
I don't care. Anything. Before I had to do readings, when I started writing in the beginning, I would not sleep for about a month if I knew I had a reading coming up. I would be like really shaky and couldn't control my voice. And I would be obviously probably pretty visibly shaky as well. And I think my heart would be beating really fast and everything. I don't know what happened to me. I wish I'd actually got over all this when I was in my 20s or yeah. something. Do you know what I mean? I wish I hadn't seen like cancer in my 50s and stopped me being a mess. But there you go. Such is life.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, so you talked about meeting your husband, getting this restaurant, and it kind of being a very exhausting process trying to keep the restaurant afloat. Tell us now about your adult change, Louise, which happened around then, if I'm right.
Well, so that was in 2014. At that stage, the restaurant had been, well, I stayed limping along. I actually don't even know how we stayed open
yeah.
for that long. I think maybe part of it was that if you have a business that's not going well, at least it's known, you know, at least you're dealing with something that you understand. But I think there could be a lot of terror around what happens if I stop.
Got you.
And I think that that's what we were really afraid of, was like, okay, bad and all as this is, what happens if we stop? So in January 2014, a friend of mine, Niamh McCabe, who's a visual artist, had been invited to join a writing group. And she said, oh, you should come along. And I said, I'd like to see what that's for. And she kept sending me text messages all day.
And why do you think she targeted you for that?
I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. I have no idea. Maybe she thought, she certainly knew that I was like going around the bend, and maybe she thought that I just needed to do something completely different. Yeah. And so I went along with her, and it was shocking, actually, the first meeting.
Describe it. What was it? Was it a group in a circle?
Well, it was a group. So it was like, about, I think the first night there were maybe about 10 people. They all seemed to be like very cool and very, like pretty much everybody there seemed to be been involved in some form of creative practice except me. Okay. And I honestly didn't think that cooking counted. But I think now that it probably does. So definitely. They were saying things like, oh, you know, I have like a chapbook of poems and I'd love help with editing it, or... I'm trying to write a memoir, or somebody was halfway through a novel and then it came to me and I was like, oh, you know, I'm here because Niamh made me come. And I was like, pierced in the face, completely mortified. So at the end of the meeting, it was agreed that every week someone would submit a short story of at least 2,000 words. And they said, well, is anybody going to do that? And I, rather than like run out crying, which is what I felt like doing, I said, okay. And I think I started trying to write it as soon as I got home.
And how did that feel?
I can actually distinctly remember opening. I didn't even have a computer. I mean, eventually when I did write the story, I had to borrow my daughter's laptop that she bought with her communion money. I'm a terrible mother. I shouldn't let her buy a laptop with her communion money. But anyway, And it had like Hello Kitty stickers all over it and everything. And oh my God. I mean, probably within it, by the end of the first paragraph, I just thought, okay, I don't actually give a shite what happens to that business or anything else in this house as long as I can just keep doing this.
Oh my God. What was the story?
I mean, I think there might be something to do with my relationship with language. I should probably have apologized at the outset because you introduced me as somebody from the North. And I am somebody, you know, that grew up in the North. But I was 12 when we left. And when I went to my new school, every time I opened my mouth, people took piss out of my accent. And I think that I'm a pretty good mimic. So it was quite easy for me to ditch my accent. But I did actually go on a Friday and think I'm not going to be speaking like that when I go back there in London because my life's not worth living. Yeah. So I did actually ditch my northern accent over a weekend with a bit shame. The reason now is that when I'm reading from Trespasses, I have to put on a Belfast accent.
I heard an inflection when you were talking about Trespasses earlier. I heard inflection. I heard it coming through. I heard it creeping in and then it creeped out again.
Yeah, it might do that a bit. Yeah. My children say when I'm annoyed that I sound very Belfast. That must be charming
sure
for them. Yeah, we'd be golden upstairs after we had a Belfast accent. But anyway.
Yeah. So was the essay about that, about language? About
No, so wondering that, I think that my spoken voice doesn't really resemble what the voice in my head.
Yeah.
But when I write, the voice is, it's the voice that's in my head. And it's northern.
Wow.
I think that's it. Which sounds bonkers.
Not at all.
I feel more like myself when I'm writing than when I'm speaking.
So when you read it back, you recognised yourself in a way that you don't when you talk, or more than when
I
you talk.
I think so. Or maybe just when I was doing it, I just feel more closer to myself, whatever that is or something, when I'm writing than I do when I'm speaking or moving around the world in other ways.
Yeah. So it kind of felt like coming home a bit.
Yeah, it did. I think it did. And maybe there's something as well about a friend of mine reckons that it has something to do with the different parts of your brain that you're using or something like that. It's whatever part of the brain we're all running away from, lions or something.
Right.
Well, I think that part of your brain can be very switched on if you're stressed a lot.
Yeah. Of which you were. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that maybe not using that or taking a break from that was probably helpful or something.
What happened next, I suppose? So you weren't in a very good place in your life. You go to this, it's this remarkable familiar feeling of coming home, recognizing whatever yourself in a way that you haven't in a while. How did your life change from that moment?
We still had the restaurant then, and I think the restaurant closed maybe in August. That was in January, and it closed in August. And when it did, I hardly even noticed. So I went from this being like this thing that was like consuming me and ruining my life, you know, whether we could keep that business going or not, actually not giving a shit. Also, I think that maybe it gave me community in a way. For years and years, I'd worked at night, I'd worked at weekends. When my kids were born, I continued to do that. And my husband used to mind them at weekends, and he'd send me photographs of them, like, you know, taking their first steps in the woods, or women, or later on, you know, with their first surfing lessons and stuff. And I was like working and thinking, oh, is that like really lovely? But back off.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, that's probably common to like lots of people who do kind of weekend work or night work and everything. Then lots of jobs.
So you had more time on your hands, I suppose.
I had more time. And but I think that maybe it's just my personality. I was never the sort of person who, you know, there's some people like joint pain.
Yeah.
Like when my kids were in school, I used to stand, you know, my arms folded as far away from the other mothers as possible. It was like, my kids would come out and say, you're actually like a delinquent. You're not like one of the parents. I was like some horrible teenager who turned up, you know, under duress to pick up their children. I just couldn't do all that.
I'm also thinking of you in the writing group going like, I just came because she invited me.
I know, it's terrible. Oh, God.
I love it.
Yeah.
So you went back to the group, I suppose.
I did go back to the group. I was in the group for maybe around 2 years or something until,
amazing.
Yeah, then when our restaurant collapsed, when I say collapsed, it just died a very slow death. Collapse is very dramatic. It's too dramatic for what happened. It just sort of fizzled out. And one day it was just gone, you know. But it meant that we both had to go on the dole. And I'd never been on the dole in my life. And my husband then figured out that we were entitled to further education grants. So he went back to school and trained to be an accountant. And I shouldn't be laughing. And I went to Queen's in Belfast and did creative writing a couple of nights a week. I stayed in my auntie's house in Belfast.
So how was it being a mature student at Queen's?
It was kind of hilarious. I can remember, so I used to stay at my aunt's house, and she lives up the road a bit from Queen's, and I was like hitting 50. The only other parents in my class, I think his mother was younger than me. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. They were all so young compared to me. And it was a bit awful. I remember the first day I went in and said hello and none of them answered me. And I did say to them afterwards, fuckers.
Why did they not answer you? What did they think you were?
I think they were all like terrified or something themselves and in their own little worlds. But it was like, could you not even, like, you know?
Acknowledge my existence.
I know, exactly. But then actually after a while, I did get to know it. I think one night I might have been out with all of my classmates, and somebody came into my aunt's house and they said, where's Louise? And I overheard her saying, oh, she'll not be up for a while. She was out again with all them wee poets. This is what I was doing, like drinking with hersey-year-old poets in the back of Leverith Bar. But anyway, I mean, I was writing too, obviously. But it was very fun, I have to say. And I think as well, maybe the fact that I went to Belfast to do that and not to anywhere else probably made a difference as well, because that was like, I mean, I guess it's the longest sustained time that I've spent in the place that I come from since I was 12.
Yeah. And what age would you have been when you did that?
I think I went back in there when I was 48, 49. And then I stayed on to the PhD as well.
Wow. How was it to learn? Like, I just know when I started writing, I could not get over the buzz it was to learn something new.
Yes, I felt like that. I don't know what I was expecting. I think what it gave me reading was feedback. You know, it gives you some kind of community where, you know, if you write something and one person says, I didn't really get that out of like 8 or 10, then that's fine. You don't have to heed it. But I think if 10 of them were going, what the hell does that mean? Then there's a problem, you know, and it's something that you should probably fix. So I think from that point of view, it was good. It also gave me deadlines. And it meant that I did have to produce a certain amount of work as well. And also, it's given me a connection to, I suppose because it was Queen specifically, it gave me a connection to Belfast as well. It introduced me to a lot of kind of, other kind of work that people are doing at the moment.
So tell me about Niamh now, your friend Niamh, who made you go to the group. Is she laughing now?
I think she did a degree in writing in Sligo, and she did an MA as well. And she's won like every competition you can imagine, and is apparently working on a novel as well. So, but even like in that writing group as well, Una Mannion, who set up the writing group, has just had her second novel published by Faber. So it was kind of unbelievable, really. Everybody was very serious from the outset.
I suppose you weren't expecting this change to go to this writing group and for it to completely, you know, change the course of your life. But now that it has, how do you feel about change in general in terms of how you've changed your life? And do you think you could do it again?
I don't know. I mean, I think the thing, that's interesting. So I think that when I joined that writing group, I didn't expect that anybody would ever think I was any good at writing. I didn't do it for that reason. Maybe that's not about the first meeting, because I went to that by accident. But I think after I went back again, I kept going back. Mm. I think I wanted to get better at it for me. I didn't think anybody necessarily had to see it. And I just liked how it made me feel better or something. It sounds ridiculous. I don't know, but it always makes me feel better in ways. Like, you know, the way it is hard. And at various points, you just think you're mad. And I just think that maybe the changes that it brought, they were like really timely, and maybe by agreeing to go there with Niamh that night meant that I was probably looking for something else. But I wouldn't have known. I didn't know that. I don't know if I could like have such radical changes again.
We had Prue Leith on this podcast, and she firmly believes in having a revolution in your life every 20 years. Like changing everything. And I mean, you've done that. Well, you did the 30 years as a chef, but you kind of have done that.
So that would mean that maybe that when I'm 70 or something, there might be another round of changes. That's kind of scary.
But I kind of think it's exciting too, no?
Yeah, maybe it's actually, okay, maybe it is, yeah.
Just the fact that it's possible.
I'm just tired.
Just the fact that it's possible, you know?
I know. Well, it is possible, that is for sure.
Yeah. Okay, change you'd still like to make or see? Last question.
Oh, I'm getting a bit fucking sick of having cancer now, to be honest. I mean, I'm not like really sick or anything, but sometimes I have a bit. It's like the first phase of treatment caused my endocrine system to go haywire, so I have to take lots of drugs for that for the rest of my life, and that's a bit of a pain in the arse.
Does that affect your day? Like, does it affect your existence?
Well, it can, but I think I'd like to not be in treatment, but then I think once you have cancer, you're just like a cancer person for the rest of your life, because it's always a thing. Like, you're always going to be scanned.
There's an awareness of it, even if you are in remission.
Yeah, I think there is. some ways, maybe that's okay because it means that maybe if something comes back, you sure. know pretty quickly because you will be scanned pretty regularly. So maybe that's all right. But yeah, just something I think you're fucking sick of the whole issue now.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, that's very fucking understandable.
Yeah.
Very. Well, listen, I thank you so much for this.
Oh, hour. Thank it's you been for having me.
Such
God
a pleasure. The only thing that could have made it better would have been a pint. And we'll have to do that in real life.
I know, we should. Absolutely. I'd love it. I'd love it. Thank you so much.
Do please rate, review and subscribe to Changes. It is so appreciated. And if you fancy sharing it on social media too, that would be amazing. The more people we can get listening to these episodes, the better. We want to tell our stories far and wide. Changes is produced by Louise Mason through DIN Productions. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.